Tennyson, I think, said, composers are simply making me do the same thing twice. And Valerie said that a song is like looking at a painting through a stained glass window. All of my life, all of it to this very day, from the beginning when I began writing songs, I have a slight feeling, not so much of guilt, but of presumption. Who am I to presume to take this finished object and do something to it? What am I doing? I'm not even quite sure what I'm doing. Am I embellishing it? Am I changing it? What I'm doing as opposed to, say, Boulez, or rather, what Boulez is doing as opposed to what I'm doing is to take a poet and frame the poet. He will therefore take a poem by, say, René Char, his principal source, and set the words to music in such a way that they can't possibly be understood, because they'll either be too high or too low, or too jagged, or above all, a given syllable would be so protracted that it can't be comprehended as we comprehend speech. And that's perfectly legitimate, I think. What I'm doing, I think, partly out of deference to the poet, is to set it pretty much at the speed of speech. I never repeat words the poet hasn't repeated, which is a sacred tenet for me. And I'm very, very surprised when composers similar to me, for example, Benjamin Britten, who writes tonal, conservative music, will repeat words, even words like the, for no apparent reason at all. If you repeat a word the poet hasn't repeated, there doesn't seem to be any reason for it. If he didn't feel a need, why should a composer repeat the word, except to say that his inspiration was longer than the poet's inspiration? Well, I feel that the composer should cut his inspiration or solve the problem melismatically.
There's some interesting issues raised by what you were just saying. And if we've been listening to these two men talk, we begin to realize very quickly that there is, to a certain degree, a conflict, a clash in the interest involved, poet and composer. We're talking about dealing with the setting of poetry and music. It's very conventional to harmonious relation or the marriage of words and text, but that doesn't look like what we've got here. Let's pursue the question in a couple of directions. Rilke was very unhappy about having his poem set, and said, in fact, that he refused permission. I think the only composer he ever let do it was Hindemith, and that it may have been posthumous, I don't remember, because he thought it violated the integrity of the poem. And there's composers like Sir Michael Tippett, for example, really won't do it, even unless they write the words themselves. So Tippett wrote a setting of Yeats's Words for Music, perhaps, in which the poetry is recited in between instrumental interludes. So what I would like to ask then, is, first of Nid Rorum, what exactly is the product? You take a poem, you obviously have a feeling of sort of responsibility to it, almost bad conscience about setting it, but yet you are interested, as you said earlier, in purveying the music. What is the amalgam, the poetry and music, supposed to be? In what way does the music respond to, represent the poetry? And after that, I'll turn to John Ashbery and ask him how he feels about being set.
In the case of Rilke and Hindemith, I think Rilke was dead, and interestingly, the only poems that Hindemith were interested in, either his native language or Rilke. T.S. Eliot was the same thing, and while he was alive, nobody was allowed to set his poems to music. I blushingly admit that when I was about 15, I took the Hollow Man and started setting that to music, and guess what? I did it for male chorus, and it opened with a series of parallel fifths. Many years later, when I was judging a contest for choral music, many other entries were settings for Hollow Man, male chorus, and opened with parallel fifths. Eliot didn't allow any of his poetry to be set by anybody in any circumstance ever. It wasn't until after he died that his wife made the kill for the cat. There's a second kind of poet. That's the kind of poet who has integrity of a us, or as they understand it. And the second kind is poets like Apollinaire and Éluard, the two favorite poets of Poulenc, who were not, at least in the case of Éluard, because I knew him, he wasn't especially musical in the sense that he didn't listen to music except Piaf. And he felt that if it amused Poulenc, we'll let him go ahead and do it. He had no objections, although he despised the voice of Pierre Bernac, because he was listening to it hoping for beauty rather than intelligence. And there's a third kind of poet that is the opposite. The Éluard kind is in between. The third kind is the poets who send composers poems through the mail. The poems are usually about the American flag or about their own libido, and it's so full of I that it's difficult for a composer to identify. It also has in the margin little suggestions. I used the word June 12 times because I know the composers like the syllable. And I think perhaps you could repeat this three times and play it in minor, ? You never get very far with that. Poets who write specifically to be set to music, and even some of the best poets, like Auden, for example, with The Rake's Progress, I find it, although it's a prosy text, I find it weak, mainly because he was pandering to the greatest composer of the century, who didn't know English very well. The way I choose a poem is that my poetry is perhaps not yours. You're a composer, and my taste in texts, I think that I try to take, all I can say is that I take a text, prose or poetry, that, as we Quakers say, speaks to my condition. There's many poems that are perhaps greater than those that I have set. And I flatter myself that whatever my songs may be worth, I've never set a bad piece of literature to music. But I wouldn't be able to take, for example, Marianne Moore, or really, or Robert Lowell, or Uplifting Poets, or I've done some Dunn, but I'm not terribly interested in doing it. I also am interested in only doing poetry in my native language. We could talk about that a little bit later. And I try to keep the integrity of the poem, as I said before, intact, not repeating. What I'm doing, I don't think, is broadening any meaning in the poem, but I'm certainly heightening it by definition, because I'm taking it higher than a poet would soberly be able to interpret himself. When it comes to living poets or poets who are friends of mine, I always feel, what are they going to think? And I really can't. I know that, for example, in the case of Elizabeth Bishop, who was an acquaintance of mine, we had a long correspondence, and she pretended to be happy with what I've done, and she was complimented and so forth, and nobody had ever said her before. But in her heart, I know that she hated it. Because a poet, and John can answer this better than I, but a poet can't help but have heard his own music when he was, or his own equivalent music when he was writing the poem, and would think that what a composer is doing is superfluous. I always feel also that I'm cheating a little bit. After all, here's this perfect thing. I don't have to do any work. The skeleton is all there. I just put a little bit of my own flesh on. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. I also try to take a poem or a piece of prose that I think is instantly communicable on some level to a listener who has never heard the words before. How do you feel, John, to simply to relay the question, when you hear your words intoned?
Well, first of all, I have the same problem you do with the human voice. I really don't like it very much. I don't particularly care for vocal music in general, and particularly English. I feel that English is simply unsuitable for being set to music.
But why? Before you get off that, tell me.
I don't know, it's kind of prissy or...
But is that because you understand English, presumably more than any other language?
Well, actually I can understand French, and I think often when I hear an opera in French, I can understand it better than an opera sung in English, which I usually can't understand at all, which is probably all best given my prejudice. The only exception I can think of is Dido and Aeneas, which does sound great, and but I always I feel uncomfortable when I hear English sung, like hearing a fingernail drawn across a blackboard. So given all this, what do I think about my own poetry being set to music? Well, I think my own poetry is kind of maybe not really poetry. It's a kind of hybrid that's sort of part music and part poetry, or at any rate, somewhere in between the two. It doesn't strike me as poetry the way we understand it, and it certainly doesn't strike very many other people that way either, I gather. And I was thinking when I was talking before about ideas that I've gotten from music, that Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, I guess they've been written by other composers as well, are something that I would very much written as poetry. In other words, a poem that's a song but that doesn't have words, it's somehow managing the status. Again, this is an impossible aim, but it's what keeps me going, so I'm not knocking it. But I think for my purposes, perhaps the most interesting setting of my music, and I'm not talking about it as music, but as the way it struck me, was a setting that was done by Eric Saltzman about 20 years ago. He took a poem of mine, which was an extremely experimental poem, which the words almost were without any reference at all. It was written during a period when I was trying to kind of reorganize what my ideas about poetry, and a lot of static came out as a result of that. And he said it in such a way that not a single word of the poem could be understood, and except for one line, which was about the only line in the poem that could actually be read as a sentence, which was, a girl with yellow pigtails takes the trolley. For some reason, you could hear that in the performance of the work that I attended at Hunter College. It was called The Nude Paper Sermon. And it had another text by somebody else in it as well. And afterwards, he sort of apologized for the performance and said that I'm afraid that your text was kind of drowned out. And I said, but that's exactly what I wanted. I was trying, and when I wrote the poem, to write something that would sound completely drowned out. And you succeeded where I failed. I think that there have been the only other setting besides your own have been by Elliot Carter, and also by an American composer named James Dasho, who lives in Italy and is not very well known in America. And he did a setting for voice and electronic music. I think your settings of my poems are perhaps the most successful that have been done from everybody else's, from the point of view of an impartial critic. I feel that the Carter perhaps, I think just as my poetry is a kind of somewhere in between poetry and music, his music is that way too, and I feel that there's a sort of an and intellect and words that come with his music, even when he's not setting words to music. And that his poet, just as his music really doesn't seem to need words for that reason, my poetry doesn't need music. It gets a kind of built-in music of its own. And again, I'm not talking about pretty sounds, but...
Your remark to Eric Salzman reminds me of Stravinsky's remark to Rubinstein. You played my music exactly the way it should be played, completely without expression. And Rubinstein didn't know how to take that. And since my whole premise about setting up music is the very reverse of Eric Salzman's, and the semi-reverse of what you say is Elliot Carter's, then you can't help but not like what I do, since I'm trying for the words to be not necessarily comprehended, but understood what is being sung. I'm a little distressed by your saying you don't like English as a language to be sung. I feel that there's no such thing as, the only thing bad about English is the song medium is bad English. But just as I try to discourage my students who write songs from setting words in foreign languages, because if we don't set American poets, who is going to do it? And it's inconceivable that any young Frenchman or any young German or any young Italian or Spaniard would spend their lives, would devote their lives to setting languages other than their own. And yet most American composers, or at least half, set words in languages that they don't speak, just as most young American singers learn to sing badly in every language except their own, which they don't learn to sing in at all. I feel that all music, all non-vocal music of every country stems from the language spoken in that country. There's a deep difference between a Beethoven symphony, which has no words, is nevertheless based with all of those strong downbeats and those achs and icks on the language that is being spoken. Arab, non-vocal Arab music sounds like the Arabic language. Spanish music differs from Italian music by having those little tildes that you can, and Italian music, respighi, that has no words, nevertheless seems full of final vowels. The only Indo-European language that has no tonic accent is French. It's the only language that has no strong rhythm to it, so that a French phrase can be set almost with any accentuation. Debussy, téléphone, those, each syllable has the same weight or can be caused to have the same weight by a composer. Only a Frenchman, therefore, could write a piece like Bolero, which is the most stodgily rhythmic piece in the world, because only a Frenchman would feel the need to prove that he too's got rhythm. I haven't wasted my time in setting French words to music, but the older I get, the more I will leave that to the French. And set not only words in English, but words by people whose language is closest to me. If I were left to my own devices, I would only set John Ashbery's music. I can't be left to my own devices because the whole art of song is, if not dead, almost dead. It's agonizing. There are no singers of songs today anywhere in the world who are primarily singers of songs, by which I mean who can earn even a frugal living singing songs. And as a result, their young composers, or even any composers of any age, are no longer writing songs according to the definition that we give. I'm lucky in that I, at least my songs get published, but there's very little competition. When I say my own devices, I mean if I'm to write a song cycle, which is never going to make any money anyway. Words that impel me are words like Ashbery, where the sense to me is not logical the way it is in another kind of poet. maybe it's the, although I can understand John Ashbery's poem being unattractive to another composer, like, for example, Richard Hundley, who writes very pretty songs, because they don't scan in the same way.
I'd like to ask each of you to comment about a particular work of yours. And after that, I think we'll give the audience a chance to hear two Ned Roaring settings of John Ashbery songs and get some comment on that. The works in question are a poem that John Ashbery wrote called Litany, and the musical work is a composition of Ned Roaring's called Sunday Morning. Each of these works has an unusual feature. Litany is a poem as published, written in double columns. The two columns are not in any obvious way related to each other, and I know that at least once a reading of the poem, where John did one of the parts, was done as a performance in which both columns were read at the same time, so that the two voices, two people are talking right past each other. In fact, it's rather like Elliot Carter's treatment in Serenia, where the mezzo-soprano sings Ashbery and a bass comes in and sings fragments of ancient Greek, commenting on the poem. Sunday Morning is an orchestral piece, which is in some sense based on Wallace Stevens' great poem, Sunday Morning. And when we talk about that, we'll try to find out what the relationship between this wordless music, another kind of song or non-song without words, and the text is. But Litany.
What about it?
Well, when you formed it that way, did you conceive that as a kind of music? Did you conceive it as, what was the impulse behind doing something which, you know, essentially, if the words are going to be understood, it would have to be sung. You can't understand two people talking at once. And yet the poem is laid out that way, and you've sort of sanctioned future performances like that.
Well, of course, I do have, by the way, you were upset that I don't like hearing English sung, and I must immediately say that this is just my, you know, a personal quirk of mine. I don't think anybody else should feel the same way. It has no universal validity at all. It's just the way I am. And I seem to have this fondness for not understanding what I hear sung. I would rather not know the words of an opera, for instance. I sort of disapprove of these subtitles that they now have. And just because the kind of words that you were talking about in the Beethoven symphony are more important and more meaningful to me than words themselves. In the case of Litany, I believe that one of the ideas, one of the things that suggested that work, although I didn't realize it until after I'd written it, was hearing a piece by Elliot Carter, the premiere of his duo for piano and violin in Cooper Union, where the violinist was at one end of this very large stage and the pianist was at the other end. In other words, they weren't grouped together as is usual with piano and violin work. And the violin sort of kept nattering on its own while the piano was sort of sulking and brooding, and then occasionally would sort of kind of skirmish with each other and one would get the upper hand. Even the interesting the way the violin was able to dominate the piano at certain times, which you wouldn't think would be possible, especially at that distance. That was something that I think started me writing this poem, which is in two parallel columns, and you're somehow supposed to be able to take them both in at the same time. I've never been able to explain to people how to do this. I suppose the only way to do it is to hear it as I once did with poet Ann Lauterbach. Another inspiration for the poem, which I realized belatedly also, was the movie The Chelsea Girls by Andy Warhol, where he makes great use of a split screen where someone will be delivering a monologue and which has no connection with what the person on the other half of the screen is talking about. And when we performed the poem together, or we didn't perform, we just read it.
Who's we? Who's the other?
Ann Lauterbach. Obviously, we in fact made a tape of it, and besides doing it part of it in public once, obviously you cannot understand very much of the poem, since it's like trying to eavesdrop on two conversations simultaneously at a cocktail party, a rather common situation, and one which I thought was probably a valid model for this poem. What happened when we read it together was, since there are stanza breaks in the poem which don't correspond, there'll be a break on the left side where the text continues on the right side, there would be frequently be moments where a single voice would be heard for a little while until the other voice began again, and these, whatever happened to be read, it didn't really make any difference at that particular time, took on a tremendous meaningfulness and urgency just because you could actually understand it for a while before being plunged back into the semi-comprehensible babble of two people talking at the same time. Again, this was an attempt, misguided perhaps, to approach polyphony in music.
Have you ever thought of making a record where you would be both voices, doing a voiceover on your own voice? Or are you interested in a more differentiated two sexes, in other words?
Well, yes, that was why, in fact, I thought it'd be a woman's voice would be good to have in this situation.
The whole business about what's musical and what ain't is partly a question of who's talking, and partly an absolute question. I think that the most musical of all instruments, and certainly the oldest, is the human voice, and it's the instrument which all other instruments seek to emulate, even the piano, even the kettle drums. Insofar as an instrument is an instrument, it seeks to be a human voice. And the very seeking is what gives it its expressivity. The reason singers themselves can be so dumb, or used to be, is because they have an advantage over all the other instruments. Their instrument is the most immediately telling. They don't even have to know what they're singing about to break your heart. The least musical of instruments is the spoken voice, as far as I'm concerned. I have a loathing of what's called melodrama, even in Stravinsky's Persephone, or in Debussy's Martyrdom of St. Sebastian, or Lincoln Portrait of Copland. I just wish the voice would shut up and let the music take over. Voices together, nothing is more great than the Bach B minor Mass or the Verdi Requiem. The ability of the composer to superimpose voices, both in undifferentiated counterpoint, as in the case of Bach, where they're all singing the same kind of music, or in the sextet from Lucia, where six different people are singing different kinds of music, and yet it meshes. But even when you get two voices, as in John's poem, let alone three or four spoken together, chaos has to ensue, as at the cocktail party. The human ear can follow, I think, up to five strands simultaneously, but it can't make intellectual sense out of more than that. I think and I also think literature is literature and music is music, and never the twain really shall meet. Music, to get to Sunday morning, music doesn't mean anything unless the composer will tell you, doesn't mean anything concrete or identifiable, unless the composer tells you in words what it's supposed to mean. If you take Debussy's La Mer and play it for a person who has never heard of it, and before the playing tell that person that this represents three images of Paris at dawn in Le Havre, at noon in the slaughterhouse, at evening along the Seine. They will hear that when they hear the music, and they'll hear that forevermore, because music is so persuasive, it'll mean whatever. It will alter everything that surrounds it. But I began simultaneously as a literary person and as a composer, and so I like to blend the two arts that I like the most into one. On two occasions, I've written non-vocal music based on poetry. And the first was Walt Whitman's Dalliance of the Eagles, in a tone poem called Eagles, in which I took the 17 lines of the poem and took each of the 17 lines separately and coldly before I set any notes on paper and described to myself in the margin what the orchestration would be that would illustrate this image, both the words by themselves and the collection of words strung together, and then the 17 lines in turn strung together. And it's a literal interpretation of Walt Whitman's Eagles. The second time I wrote a piece in 8 movements based on the 8 stanzas of Sunday Morning, and I tore from their content 3 or 4 or 5 word titles to give titles to each of these movements. And sometimes I would write the whole piece and then give it the title, the way Debussy did with his preludes. He would think up titles or ask his friend, what does this sound like? They'd say it sounds like Moonlight on a Forgotten Temple. And he said, oh great, that's what I'll call the piece. Sunday Morning was a trick as far as the titles is concerned. And I'm not sure that I really was inspired by Wallace Stevens specifically as I was by Whitman, so much as I was happened to be reading that poem at the same time, and it was a better title than simply Suite for Orchestra.
Did you know that the English composer Robin Holloway, do you know his music?
Yeah, I know it and I admire it.
Yeah, me too. And he also did a similar setting of Wallace Stevens' poem, Domination of Black, in which he did not use the text. It's an orchestral, purely orchestral one. He also set very famous poem, Stevens, whose name escapes me, but to want effect.
Sea Surface Full of Clouds.
And he did that for chorus orchestra solely, but then he went back and did that.
He does William Carlos Williams too. Do you know him?
Yes, I do.
Well, he's very English, but he's very, in a way, he's not quite as, he has a relaxation that Americans have, but he's still got an English accent, and so does his music. And it's interesting, therefore, how he approaches the same language, but with a slightly different accent. It would be interesting, in fact, to write an essay on the difference between, say, when I set Cecilia Plath's music 15 years ago, at the beginning of the feminist movement, one of my best friends, Robin Morgan, a woman, turned on me at a party and all but spit in my face and said, how dare you set Plath? She belongs to us. Set your male poets, but leave Plath to me and my sisters. And I felt, well, the hell with you. A poem in a way, the reason I could do John Ashbery is a poem once it's written doesn't belong to anybody, even to the poet. And Sylvia Plath was dead, and I wasn't, and I wanted to do her at that point. But thinking about it later, it's interesting to ponder whether there is a difference in kind between a male composer and a female composer, or an English composer and an American. But the difference is a lot slighter than the difference between a good composer and a bad composer, I think. And I don't think that one can prove those differences. It's amusing, but it's not very important.
Let's have the opportunity now to listen to those two settings of John's poems, The Thoughts of the Young Girl and Fear of Death. And I thought that it might be not a bad idea if John were to read those poems first. Or maybe we should do it one at a time. Like, is Fear of Death first in the page?
They follow each other And since in the music they follow each other, then if John Ashbery wants simply to read the two of them together, it might be fine, it might be useful. But then I'll say a brief word about the cycle, and then we can play it.
Good, we can play it. John?
So, should I read them together?
Yeah, Fear of Death first, and then Thoughts of the Young Girl.
Fear of Death. What is it now with me, and is it as I have become? Is there no state free from the boundary lines of before and after? The window is open today, and the air pours in with piano notes in its skirts, as though to say, look, John, I've brought these and these. That is, a few Beethovens, some Brahmses, a few choice Poulenc notes. Yes, it is being free again, the air. It has to keep coming back, because that's all it's good for. I want to stay with it out of fear that keeps me from walking up certain, knocking at certain doors, fear of growing old alone, and finding no one at the evening end of the path except another myself, nodding a curt greeting. Well, you've been a while, but now we're back together, which is what counts. Air in my path, you could shorten this, but the breeze has dropped and silence is the last word. Thoughts of a Young Girl. It is such a beautiful day, I had to write you a letter from the tower and to show I'm not mad. I only slipped on the cake of soap of the air and drowned in the bathtub of the world. You were too good to cry much over me, and now I let you go, signed, The Dwarf. I passed by late in the afternoon, and the smile still played about her lips as it has for centuries. She always knows how to be utterly delightful. Oh, my daughter, my sweetheart, daughter of my late employer, princess, may you not be long on the way.
In 1979, I wrote a song cycle of 10 songs using 6 poets, and I duplicated some of the poets. Fear of Death is the 7th, Young Girl is the 8th of this cycle. If I had been writing not a cycle but isolated songs, I might have approached the words quite differently. I might have made them fast or not. I don't think there's one inevitable word said in any poem. They were written specifically for the soprano, Phyllis Brynjulfsson, who sings them. It's just for voice and piano. Fear of Death is just for voice and piano, and Thoughts of a Young is for voice alone, a cappella, unaccompanied, which is then followed by a 9th song that we won't play here. The only other thing I'll say is that under the word Beethoven, Brahms, and Poulenc notes, I quote, not so subliminally, those three composers, just it going by in passing. So Peter, if I punch, play, and hope for the best. That's what I'm supposed to have. That's the previous song. So we'll play it and just go into the next one, which is Fear of Death.
Thank you.
Take a bow after that. The singer who isn't even here. For where we're sitting, it was quite frustrating because the speakers go out. I don't know if this had an effect.
I'd like to.
I'm just rewinding.
Oh, okay. I'd like to ask. One of the really striking effects produced by that sequence is the move from the ordinary accompaniment. I shouldn't say ordinary accompaniment, but the fact, you know, we expect piano under the voice, and you do set Thoughts of a Young Girl for a solo singer. What was the motive for doing that? What did you
Because at that point I needed a solo singer. It was strictly a cold-blooded decision at that point. I can't remember the order in which I, any longer, in which I wrote all of these songs, but I knew that before the penultimate song and the final outburst, I wanted a moment of repose that would come from an unaccompanied song. It's not that the poem itself indicated a solo voice, although it rather does, but I decided I wanted a solo voice and then found the poem rather than finding a poem and say, oh boy, this is great for solo voice.
John?
And you know perfectly well what I mean as a
Oh yes, John. What do you think about that? There's your poem. It's innocently sitting there, and all of a sudden, it's set for a solo voice. Let me rephrase the question. You're sitting there listening to the music. How do you feel that it represents or misrepresents those two texts, which are written quite a distance in time apart? One is a relatively early poem, one's relatively recent.
Yeah, well, the second one is about 20 years earlier than the first one. I like very much the second one, the Thoughts of a Young Girl. I think it's quite brilliant. I think you have these sort of swoopings and what seem to be sort of mad ornaments and very suitable for a poem in which the speaker doesn't seem to have a very strong hold on reality, since he's referring to the person he's addressing by a number of different appellations. Daughter of my late employer, Princess, these can't all be the case. And this all may be a result of having slipped on the cake of soap of the air and drowned in the bathtub of the world, which I thought was very beautifully rendered in the song. There seemed to be a sort of upward skid as the person slipped on the egg itself, and then there seemed to be some kind of bubbles and gurgling after hitting the bathtub. The The other, there was a kind of, it seemed to me that the accompaniment of the first song was always kind of catching up to itself and also suggesting something about the poem. For instance, the idea that the air could shorten this path of life, but doesn't choose to, and therefore there seemed to be a slightly, maybe out of breath or tripping quality in the, it seemed like a sort of 3-4 beat in the accompaniment, which I thought very meaningfully exemplified the text without embroidering or sort of making an issue of it.
None of these things was in my mind when I wrote the music. And I didn't even understand the poems in the same way that John Ashbery was commenting on them. Now, sometimes I don't understand. I don't understand poetry. I mean, it's not there to be understood anyway, the same way that the thesis on radioactivity is, or something. But I do feel it. Sometimes 10 years after I've said a poem, I'll suddenly, it'll hit me, oh my God, is that what that poem means? Or is that what I made it mean? Or is that how I misrepresented the meaning completely? I didn't quite realize, for example, that the speaker of Thoughts from a Young Girl was that unfocused, necessarily.
I didn't either until I heard your setting.
Also, I'm inclined, a song like Fear of Death, it's all based on a pedal point of C sharp over and over again. I didn't occur to me then, but it could be analyzed as that being the obsession of the person who fears death, though that was far from my mind when I wrote it. What was in my mind was take the poem, which did, by the way, speak to me, because I feared death, and I think about it all the time. So that was a very emotional situation, plus there were musical implications with the names of the composers. But after that, I'll take a poem and simply say part one, part two, part three, back to part one, climax toward the climactical moment, which John might not have thought himself, because a poem doesn't exist in time in the same way that a piece of music necessarily exists. The song will always take 3 minutes and 22 and a half seconds, but the poem can be read by anybody and at different speeds and to yourself in silence. So I gave it a form that it didn't necessarily have as far. I gave it a climax that might not have been in your mind. That's how I think when I'm writing music.
Where the climax, and where would you situate it in the piece?
Just before the end, where most climaxes are. Yeah. And I try to force every set, even if it's a four-line poem, into A, B, C, which is the climax, and then A again, coming back. That's the conventional conservative. I usually end up in the key where I began, too, no matter how far I may stray.
John, did you conceive of the poem as having a climax at any point?
I can't remember.
I'll even take a word that John couldn't necessarily think of. In this case, the highest note in the song is, except another, is on the of that word. And it's a high B flat and holds there for a long time. It's not because another suggests height, it's because is easy to sing on a high note. And also, I said, what syllable can I give a high note, a syllable that is coming toward the end of the poem? Plus, I knew that the last phrase, that the breeze had dropped, is so obviously both in the poem and the music, an ending, that would be my ending too. Mm-hmm. It would be dumb to not to do it. It would be perverse and ineffectual not to do it that way.
Did you do anything specific with the intrusion or the insertion of the name John into the poem? poem. Both this song and this poem are favorites of mine, but the climax of the poem for me has always been precisely that moment when the wind says, look, John.
That's toward the beginning.
It's toward the beginning, exactly. And it always struck me as a very daring and expressive moment because there, you know, the...
I knew when I wrote it that it would be a woman singing it. I, who didn't know John Ashbery, though I've known John Ashbery for many, many, many years. I don't like autobiographical references, although of course I did make musical references here. I think I tried to underplay it. It's part of the poem. It's in the which a singer will sing, and singers don't have sex. They are beyond that.
What about you? Did you have any particular thing in mind when you did that? It's a somewhat unusual thing to do, after all.
What, to refer
to refer to yourself by name in that way? Browning does it once.
I wrote a play, actually, called The Compromise, which might have given me the idea to do that. And in the end, all the characters decide they've had enough of the play and go off into the night together, and the author comes on the stage and pleads with them not to go, and especially when there's a little boy character that says, not you, Jim, you stay here with me, and the character says, goodbye, Mr. Ashbery. But that I those are the only occasions on which I've ever addressed myself.
There was one poem in which I can't remember the title of the poem, but I remember the line very well. It's Mountain Ash Mindlessly Dropping Berries.
I want to ask John Ashbery a question, which is, it's something that occurred to me several years ago, but I haven't thought about it since, and maybe it's dumb, but it occurred to me 15 or 20 years ago that when John Ashbery and also his friends Frank O'Hara and to some a lesser extent Kenneth Cope, in their poetry, especially John's, which has to be, or had to be at least then, considered up to date or modern or absolutely contemporary, experimental, all those things, not like Robert Frost or like Howard Moss, who is sort of a contemporary. But when they would write about music, the music they would write about, as I remember it in their poems, was not the music of Boulez or Elliot Carter, but of Glazunov or Rachmaninoff. Composers who were not only comparatively tame 19th century, but madly romantic and unmodern. That's simply a statistic, which is neither here nor there. Perhaps a more conventional poet would write about ultra-modern composers if they wrote about composers at all. Is that of any interest, or have I said anything that needs to be said about that?
I don't know why we did this. You might mention also that Wallace Stevens talks about Liadov, a Russian composer of the same stripe as Rachmaninoff and Glazunov and everything. It was to probably as a kind of shorthand to get a note of mawkish romanticism into the poem at a point where it seemed appropriate, and not particularly because we valued those composers above others. It struck me recently, though, that O'Hara, well, he actually wrote music and studied it at Harvard. And I and our friends who have since become called the New York School of Poetry were always much more interested in music than in the other arts, even although O'Hara, of course, had the involvement with the painting and abstract expressionism in particular. I seem to remember my youth at post-college New York, we were constantly going to concerts rather than poetry readings or plays and playing records to each other. And I don't know what this means exactly, but...
I know that in case of O'Hara, his friends who were composers, like like Morton Feldman were not exactly Rachmaninoff. And the people he would write blurbs for on record albums, but they aren't the ones he wrote.
I think Rachmaninoff sounds better than Morton Feldman. Maybe he obeyed the same rules you did when you were setting the word another or something similar to that.
You've talked about the influence of certain avant-garde movements on your, or at least on your earlier poetry, though, John. John Cage has come up, Debern. Does that persist to the present, or have you adopted other musical sources of inspiration?
Well, those composers were very useful to me in a time of need when I was really perplexed at how to go on writing, and the sort of the radicalism of Cage on the one hand and Bateman on the other at different periods were very useful, not to go on about it, but when I was living in Paris and feeling kind of out of touch with my native language, the complete album of Webern came out at that time, and I got it in his isolating a note or a chord and sort of presenting it in a way so that you felt you had never heard it before was something that I thought I would try to do with our language, which is why I produced those very fragmented poems, including the one I mentioned earlier that Eric Saltzman had said. Now I listen to certain kinds of music. It varies from time to time. I went through a Monteverdi period several years ago. Now most convenient music for me to listen to the right poetry as a composer, I'm sure Ned would disapprove of, Franz Schmidt, kind of a very eclectic Austrian composer who, although an exact contemporary of Schoenberg, was kind of at the opposite pole from him musically, a very postmodern kind of Maulerian without the drama of the Sturm und Drang of Mahler.
Would you like to write an opera libretto?
Well, I'm afraid I'd fall into the pitfall that you were mentioning earlier of poets who try to write for composers and make everything easy for them.
But it wouldn't be poetry, it would be prose, which is a radically different.
I don't know, it's sort of a thankless, it would be...
It doesn't tempt you then.
It would be a tremendous amount of work, and then when I got done, all I'd have was it would be a libretto. On the other hand, it's something I think about fairly often.
Yeah, no, I don't think you'll do it.
Virgil Thompson once asked me to write one, and I suggested, I think, some 19th century novel, and he said, I don't want anything that takes place in libretto land, no hoop skirts. And then, of course, he set Lord Byron to
shake his mind. I'd like to focus attention back for 1 minute on the very ending of Fear of Death, both poem and setting. The line of some silence is the last word. To a reader, at least to one who's sort of accursed by literary critical education like myself, that line embodies a pun of several different dimensions. It's thick with different kinds of meanings. Now, can you, or would you want to, get that kind of thing into the music? This is obviously a very important line, and the song is the last.
I'm perfectly capable of taking that very same poem now and setting it to music again, differently. And I once, in 1962, actually, I wrote a whole song cycle called Poems of Love and the Rain that uses eight poems, and each of them is set by eight different Americans. And the poems are either about rain or love, or rain and love. and I set each of them to music twice. And if the first setting was slow and passionate, the second would be very fast and skittering. And if the first was intent, the second would be relaxed. And my point was that if a poem is really good, there is no one inevitable way of setting it. But when Debussy and Rinaldo, Hahn and Verlaine all took the same clair de lune and set it to music, they would all write more or less the same kind of moonlit music. Whereas when I took Auden's Stop All the Clocks, the first time was very, very like a blues song, and the second was like an epileptic fit, and both of them seemed to work. The order of the songs, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, then an interlude by Rethke, for unaccompanied voice, by the way, and then 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Therefore, all of the words were repeated, but none of the music was repeated, and you went through the same experience, a completely different attitude, and it's legitimate, I think. And I think that the John Ashbery's poem is open to many, many different, there is many logical, there are as many legitimate ways of setting it to music as there are composers, or even the same composer on a different day.
Then on each, in each individual setting, though, you have to make a choice.
Of what's important.
Oh, Love in the Rain. Are all the words repeated? I think I recall that on the way back.
I cheated a little bit, but in Prince, that was my principle, and the principle is stuck to.
Was there a reason for your cheating a little bit, or is it, I'm just curious?
Well, for example, I left part of one poem out on purpose so that I could put it in Coming Back, and another one I took a poem by Jack Larson, and then I took another poem that was a mirror image of that same poem, so they varied ever so slightly. So it wasn't quite fair, but still.
John, do you contemplate at any point future musical collaborations of any sort? Given what you said about English before, maybe that's not a good question, but...
He hasn't collaborated at all, so
that's
why do you
true,
say,
that,
why
that's
say
true.
Future music?
That's true. That's perfectly true. Do you ever contemplate collaborating of any?
Well, I might very well, but no one has asked me to. It takes two to tango. I have at the present time much more free time for writing, and I'm tempting to try different things that I haven't done before, and that might well be something. You've asked me this question publicly before about whether I would like to write a libretto, but you've never asked me in private, so I don't know whether you want me to write a libretto for you or whether this is just an abstract inquiry.
It's abstract. I don't really know that poets are the best librettists, and a librettist is a person. First of all, they won't do it because there's very little glory in it for them. They are definitely given short shrift, alas. And someone like Hofmannsthal, who is the best there was really horsewhipped by Richard Strauss and kept under his heel all the time. Also, poets are the purpose, the secret of opera is not beautiful words or even singable words, but a sense of theater. Songwriters, as a rule, do not opera composers make. And opera composers, as a rule, don't write songs. I can't think of one song by Puccini, very few by Verdi, ditto Wagner. Schubert's operas weren't much. A few people can write both operas and songs, but when they're writing operas, they have to forget about songs. An opera is not a string of beautiful songs. It is a theatrical situation. Even mediocre composers can write operas that will rivet you, like, for example, Menotti's The Consul. You can't not be affected by it, and yet the music is not as good as music by less successful dramatic composers. I think poets are inclined to love their own words in such a way that the words would stand in the way of getting somebody across the stage or get the dagger stuck in the heart of the heroine. And by the same token, for opera composers to write songs, to be able to trim down necessarily their work so that it's minimal, and to be able to pack a wallop in just 2 minutes instead of 2 hours. It's not the same thing.
Well, there seems to be a question of narrative.
I would rather take a play by an American and then cut it to bits.
Preferably than a dead American who couldn't object.
And I can't think of one for the moment that attracts me particularly.
So we'll have to hold on the libretto for the time being.
I think the ideal situation from my point of view is to have something set that I've already written, which is in fact what has happened up until now.
I would sometimes think that, for example, I might take 20 of John's poems and decide arbitrarily that some would make trios, duets, quartets, sextets, solos, and then take six singers and divide these poems between the six singers in a way that suited my purpose and put them on little platforms around the stage and have them lit in different ways and try to think of a scenario that would be directed by somebody with genius so that the scenario became implicit. It wouldn't have to be logical, but it could be implicit and like a little like four stages and three acts.
Interesting.
That, I think, might be the answer to me as a composer of operas, since I've already stubbed my toe on much more conventional ways of doing it.
As T.S. Eliot once said, that poetry is a mug's game, and I've sometimes thought that opera is probably even more so. There's one of the interesting things about this conversation is revealed the diversity of musical styles which have been applied to one man's poetry. In this case, John Ashbery's. We have an electronic composition. We have the Saltzman composition, which was so successful at drowning you out. You have Carter's piece. You have the Roaring songs. I mean, all of these are quite different from quite different parts of the musical universe. Do you have any preferred style, vocal or compositional, which you prefer to hear your music set? Is there anything more or less alien about one or the other of those ways of proceeding with your words?
I think Mr. Durham's probably the best. No, I like the fact that people of such varied orientations have seen something they wanted to set. I've in fact tried to make it as open-ended as possible.
See, the trouble is you're so non-possessive about it. You have to get a poet who is desperate to hold on to his own words.
I don't think poets who hold on to their own words are usually very good poets. Sometimes they, when they think it's all that sacred.
It's not as though I was losing them either.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they're always there in a book. I remember Marvin Levy made a huge 2-hour cantata out of Auden's Christmas Oratorio. Auden said, change whatever you want, and repeat, and do this and do that, because the poem. And lesser poets get terribly demanding.
What about prose? The question of setting prose would seem to be quite different from setting poetry.
Respectful as I am of poets, of a poem as an integral thing, I'm not at all with prose. And when I take prose to make songs out of it, I don't mean just operas. Whitman, for example, the big chunks of his diaries that I've taken, I've cut them shamefully or shamelessly, changed order and all sorts of things because to get, and he's easy to cut because he's so rhapsodic and so repetitious. But I wouldn't dream of doing that even to a Whitman poem. I wouldn't dream of doing it to a poem. I think prose is an operatic decision and songs are a poetic decision. And opera is not a question of poetry. It's a question of librettos and prose.
John, you wrote something called Three Poems, which is interesting because it is apparently prose. Which is it? We're going to
both. It's like Rimbaud's poems in prose.
Yes, except but much more extended. There are three of them, but they're continuous.
I know them, and I think they're poetry, in case John can't answer the question. It's poetry.
Well, they're called poems, of course, but on the other hand, the prose in them is often extremely prosaic, or at any rate, extremely expository prose. It's, although there are lush passages in it, I was trying to examine the possible poetic content of different kinds of prose, which might seem very far removed to one's conception of prose poetry.
And this would be, I suppose, an example of what you meant before, when you talked about a kind of music of thought in the work, which is not dependent on any obvious lyricality or musicality in the verse.
Yeah.
When you come to a poetic text, which is characterized by a diversity of different voices, quick changes from one level of style to another, have you set pieces like that, or have you avoided them?
Within a given poem.
Within a given poem, yeah.
But they are, that's no longer a song.
I see what you mean. I was thinking, for example, some poems by William Carlos Williams, for example. I mean, they're certainly lyric poems, but there are rapid changes in tone and diction within a very, very short space. And
yes, but I don't try to Mickey Mouse it. The two Williams poems that I have set, I don't try to do what he's doing. I try to force it into my mold. I think it's very dangerous to imitate rhythms of a poet. I don't think it can be done. And I think that besides, I don't see it as that kaleidoscopic as the way you seem to see it with William Carlos Williams' poems. Mm. Or if I do, I pretend not to, so that it'll fit my music. It might fit your music that way, but time isn't running.
Oh, good question. Your job?
It's about 20:10.
Oh, I guess we're about done. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.